You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Brian Curtin. He's talking to me from Bangkok, Thailand. Brian, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hi, thank you.
Brian, let's talk about what you're working on right now. I mean, we're going to talk about a number of things, but of course, it's also February 2nd, 2021. This is still a pandemic going on. And in Thailand, there's also some political upheaval. So just to get a sense of, if you can, what's the feeling at the moment? What's happening in Thailand? And then we'll get into your work. But in terms of COVID, what's the feeling now? And politics, right? There's a lot of shifts happening there.
There is a lot of, first of all, in terms of COVID, like I'm from Ireland, I'm Irish, and I was sort of in lockdown in Ireland. I went back and stayed for 7 months last year. So Thailand, I mean, Ireland was good. England, I think, wasn't so good in terms of sort of, what's the term, like containing the problem. But Thailand has proved itself massively efficient. I mean, when I flew into Bangkok last August, it was like coming into a post-nuclear zone. I mean, all the sort of airport helpers, the workers were all covered up in plastic. You go into a mandatory hotel quarantine for 50 nights, no alcohol, food is at your door three times a day. And I also teach at a university here, so then all the teaching was online. And this is happening, and amidst what is happening is protests of thousands and thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people, against the current monarchy over perceived corruption. And by the way, it's illegal in Thailand to make any negative remarks about the monarchy, so I'm not sure how much I should say. Happened basically is that in 2014 there was a military coup. By 2018-19 the people from the military had formed themselves into a political party, and through widely criticized elections they were allegedly voted in. I think it was 2019. So we basically got a military type a government. But for a long time, over the last 20 years or so, there's been a lot of cracks showing in the sort of fabric of Thai society. There was the violent protest in 2010 against the so-called yellow shirts and red shirts. The yellow shirts are perceived as a sort of conservative elite, while the red shirts are a type of leftist, rural, working class. So... and they had voted for the previous prime minister, who was then, you know, removed in a coup under accusations that he was supplanting the authority of the king. I mean, I don't know how much I can say.
That's fine. That's part of what's going on there, of course.
Because remember, up until the last king, who was the longest reigning monarchy in the world. I mean, the ideology of the monarchy tended to work quite effectively in Thailand, but with his passing, Rama 9 and now Rama 10, Rama X, there is this sort of problem that he isn't seen as managing as good as the other. I don't want to get myself into problems, but yeah, so...
That's okay,
you said enough. So anyway, that's a good lead into the work I'm actually doing, because for 4 years I've just written a book. It's a survey of contemporary art in Thailand, which stretches from around the late 80s to current artists. The book will be published by Reaction Books in the UK. It's quite coffee table, but the publication of it has been postponed. I'm not sure why, maybe COVID. It was supposed to come out, be published last November. Now it should be published in June. But the narrative of the book addresses that, which is basically the sort of shift from nationalist interests on behalf of artists from, say, the 80s and 90s to now more post-nationalist influences among more recent generations of artists. So there's that shift, yeah, nationalist, post-nationalist. Because having the ideology of Thainess, the sort of nationalist ideology that most countries have, most nation states have, as a type of glue to keep the population together, it's somewhat been exposed as a manipulative ideology that to keep certain hierarchies, certain elites in place. And that's what I think a recent generation have woken up to. So a lot of their work is quite critical and deconstructive about this ideology of Thainess. A lot of artists are studying abroad more. They're making work that has more sort of layered, multiple references, etc., etc. So the situation here, and also intellectually, sorry, I don't want to talk too much. Yeah, intellectually, the situation has, I've been in Bangkok 20 years, so there's a lot more critical discussion in public now. So they would be the major changes. And it's they're tied in the political context of the country and how I wrote about art. But my book is not an academic book. It tends to be it's quite an introductory survey.
So let's talk about the book a little more then, because that has been your focus for a while, I imagine, this book together. And the book, in a way, talks about or brings together a number of aspects of your personal practice and your writing and your life living in Thailand, right? So so to get a little deeper into this book, which is sounds like it's filled with art. Yeah, can we talk about some of the art in the book that may speak to some of the central ideas in the book?
Sure. Well, there's different ways to actually talk about it. I mean, I would say up until the 80s, 90s, artists, like one way to talk about it is that artists, like you take someone like Monty Mbunma, who's the sort of godfather of modern art in Thailand, his practice would have been very much about sort of making sort of hybrid forms between so-called Eastern and so-called Western, or Western and Eastern influences, and to try and resolve this relationship in a way that otherwise you have work that, say, might be very Buddhist, might be considered, other artists might be dealing with work that would be very legible or identifiable as sort of a very Thai iconography. So artists like Monty Mbunma were very influenced by some major modern movements in the West, like Art Prevero, poor art from Italy, and he studied in France and process art. He did use a lot of Buddhist imagery in his work, but he created very original forms. They weren't fully Western, they weren't fully Thai. So that was a sort of precedent that Montian set for a lot of younger artists. And the artists that came up then, say, after him. But yeah, and then there was, what am I saying? So I think that's one of the points, this hybrid forms, Western influence, Eastern references, if we think about it in certain terms, that just went away. That sort of dialogue, that discourse sort of stopped at some point. It became, because what we went then witnessed and saw in the 80s was this sort of global rise. We were becoming more and more aware of art from other countries, other cultural contexts. So that sort of idea of a sort of Western influence, this sort of split, just started to fall out of view, because a lot of the art that was emerging then, due to the internet, due to the growth of biennales, just as we know, the whole increased circulation of knowledge about arts from different countries pressurized that type of, we might say, binary of East-West. And in that context,
Right. So let's talk more about that, just that kind of art, because there's such interesting things happening. And in one sense, you know, I think of the global biennials as a kind of arbiter of the global of the conversation, right? What the art world is talking about, and it tends to be in some ways a similar conversation in terms of even materiality or non-materiality and conceptual ideas, but also there's been this rise in or it's that's how I see it, but I'm not saying this is by any means what's happening. But a rise in wanting to bring in contemporary art from areas like the Middle East, like areas that are unrepresented, and have that work not just speak to the global dialogue, but also speak to what's happening in that country, in that area, in that region. So, it seems, maybe you can speak to this, but it seems that there's almost two things going on. On one hand, the Western influence is getting more artists from all over the world into global biennials in that conversation. But at the same time, that conversation wants to hear specific points of view, right? What's happening in the Middle East? What's happening in Thailand? You know, and then they want the art to be critical of that somehow. You know what I'm saying? Is that what's happening? Because it seems like that's almost a contradiction. At one point, we want art to contribute to this global dialogue that's somewhat similar among all Western artists. And on the other hand, we want it to talk about marginalized communities or communities that haven't been in the global view and hear specifically from them.
I think that's an extremely an interesting question. And I think what it does is impact on sort of how art is written. So it would impact on ideas about art criticism. So therefore, what happens when you're faced with artwork, say, in whether Paris or Korea, in these global biennales, where simply the iconography or the methods are not so familiar. I mean, I think of my friend, the Thai artist Jackai Siribut, who creates tapestries that are highly decorative and that use a lot of esoteric symbolism. He's the perfect example for what you're talking about. He's shown in New York. He has a very good career. He certainly has benefited from these like global circuits. But how his work is written, how his work is thought about, is sort of a challenge because it cannot be assimilated to the sort of modern art history narrative or contemporary art historical narratives that have been handed down to us from the West. There are certain writers like Joan Key or Julian Stalabras who have pointed this out, that when we look at a lot of what passes for contemporary art, a lot of it is comparable. A lot of it is, you know, there's no unironic religious art. There's no very sentimental art. The debates between art and craft at the moment are ironically very strong, this sort of hierarchy and difference between art and craft that we have. So on the one hand, we have, I think, as you pointed out, this increased knowledge, increased awareness of art from multiple countries, but how we think about it, how we curate it, how we write about it, that's where the real challenges are. Like Jackai, again, is a very important, Jackai Siribut is a very important example, because I know Western audiences within art galleries are not so used to these heavily decorative artworks. You're not used to religious art that isn't ironic in some way. So that's where the sort of values or ideas that underline this need to be questioned in some way. But I think it's really an impact on how maybe art criticism is written. And from a personal point of view, I'm not the person really to actually do that. My brain is very Western soaked. But I think certain writers like James Elkins, or at least having said that, I mean, I read queer theory, so there is a way of taking something apart. But I think writers like James Elkins at the Art Institute of Chicago have pointed this out, that a lot of writers have the same reference points. There's a lot more to... There's another point to make is that art criticism in Southeast Asia has never been very strong. So there's no real debate among artists themselves outside of the previous sort of nationalist discourses is how much, remember, like we're talking about countries that were nation building in the mid-20th century. So they would have been the predominant discourses that artists were caught up with. Since that's receded a bit, again, there's no real discussion among artists about debates about form, debates about process. So another way, yeah, which you might have in the West, but you also have a lot of, a friend of mine said he thinks a lot of the work that comes out of Thailand is very bombastic. It's not subtle, it's very, and it's very much appealing to another critic, Yola Lenzi in Singapore, has pointed out a lot of the work in the region sort of aims to speak very directly to audiences in a sort of visceral way. So yeah, I mean, they would be the points floating around at the moment. There is a lot changing. There's a journal, Southeast of Now, Directions in Modern and Contemporary Art in Asia, that comes out of Singapore, an academic journal that's excavating a lot of new writing, new ways of thinking, new theories. So it feels like you might be at the beginning of something new here.
And you mentioned you were talking about, you know, decorative art, which, you know, I know you've written about before, and queer theory. Let's talk about that a little bit, because that's also something that I think, as you've said, has been marginalized, right? We're often not thinking about that, and even that comment of it, of work being bombastic, may or may not fit into that sense of decorative art. But can you speak to that a little bit? Because you've written about that before, and I don't know if this also figures into your book at all. But the role of you know, so-called decorative art and how it has been marginalized. Is that at all part of your book? I know that's been part of your previous writings.
Oh, thanks. It's actually not touched on in any deep way in the book. Again, the book is quite light. I try to publish when I can more research-based work, but it's always slight conflict with me because also I write for magazines. I mean, I think what queer does is basically sort of revives what we think we know. A troubled category. If you think about queer theory as about a sort of deconstruction or challenge to strict notions of identity, it follows objects have identities, our relationships to objects have identities. So it's that type of thing that can be unpacked. I mean, you could draw a link between say someone like very decorative work or work that's almost quite kitsch. I mean, you can draw links between that and say someone like Leni Riefenstahl, Hitler's filmmaker, and therefore begin to address this in more important terms as something that's pernicious, something that's seductive, and unpack. Like, writers have written on that, and queer writers. You could also talk about emotion. I think Jennifer Doyle, that can be your other question, but Jennifer Doyle has written about emotion in contemporary art and how we train ourselves to hierarchize our responses to artworks. But also art history gets written in that way. We're told what's important and what's not important. If I'm being clear. The sort of regulations of desire, emotion, physical responses, how these things are very queer and they can be unpacked in lots of ways. And a very clear example would be to look at someone like Leni Riefenstahl, who's a very contentious artist, or was a very contentious filmmaker, obviously, and link, expand some of these discourses, like through Susan Sontag, expand them into discussions about kitsch, decoration, what it means to be beguiled by artworks. These are often quite sort of dangerous, dangerously political states. But within the context of art, that they can be explored. I mean, they're the ideas I'm trying to think of now, maybe for next, for future work.
Yeah, that's interesting. So speaking of far future work, what is this book's coming out, and congratulations for when it does come out, and completing that. What are you currently involved in or looking forward to?
I'm just working with I'm one of the advisory board for Jonathan Katz. You know Jonathan V. Katz, a gay historian I think he teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's currently working on a major touring show called The First Homosexuals. And this is an exhibition that surveys internationally the types of artworks that emerged around after the so-called invention of homosexuality in the late 19th century, when homosexuality became understood as a sort of modern deviance. So he's looking at how artists actually responded to that identity. And I've been helping him with Southeast Asia. And it's a very large show. It's backed by the Alpha Wood Foundation in Chicago. I think it will begin traveling from 2023. So I'd be looking at that for this region, which is more difficult because the chronology is not the same. It wasn't parallel, but sort of homosexuality, what was it? So-called invented here in the late 19th century, but I've been looking at how the history of colonial era laws did bring in anti-sodomy statutes and trying to think about what impact those statues had locally. And what's also interesting to note is that homophobia was actually maintained by more indigenous beliefs like Buddhism or Islam. So I'm trying to look at those tensions and to understand them in some way. And the modern period for German for gender and sexuality would have been 50s, 60s in Thailand. These are all like highly speculative. Also, psychology, psychoanalysis as a discipline, which were some of the major technologies of homophobia in the West. They were never that quite strong here, or they weren't strong until later. So, yeah, that's what I'm actually looking at the moment, and how certain local figures, like shaman figures in Burma, often, you know, who've existed since the 12th century, shamans, like otherworldly, you know, like basically spirit mediums, how they, they may have been around since the 12th century, but in the 20th century, under the influence of ideas about homosexuality, homophobia, they often became spaces for gay men, queer men, lesbians, to actually live a sort of safe life. It was okay to be queer so long as you were a shaman. So I'm interested in that, and in how certain cultural figures became coded.
That's very interesting. Yeah, perhaps in the future we can talk again about that work. That sounds fascinating. Brian, I want to ask you one more question. What are you reading at the moment?
We could go back, actually, the conversation could roll on, because we can go back to Thailand and some of the things we've discussed. So there's a Thai photographer, actually, who's based in the US, who did a series of sort of very glossy photographs of underage male street walkers, sex workers, / prostitutes in Bangkok that were very controversial. He also made a film. The film was recently censored when it was shown in an LGBT exhibition in Bangkok. So while the photographs are disturbing, he probably shouldn't have taken them. They seem exploitative. But I'm wondering to try and respond to that more critically in some way. So I would say what I'm reading leads into is Ariella Azoulay's recent work on photography and citizenship. And I've been reading some of Kaja Silverman's earlier work on the history of photography from the 19th century. And Silverman argues against the predominant view of photography is something like it objectifies, it exploits. You know, Silverman elaborates a much more interesting theory that photography is innately ambiguous. It's very difficult to define exactly what it means. And Ariella Azoulay's work, if I can get it clear in terms of citizenship, in the case of Olma's photographs, which are these very young figures standing against, you know, desolate streets, you know, someone like Azoulay would argue in terms of photography and citizenship, the figure is telling you, I'm here, I exist, but I'm hidden. I'm a citizen with partial rights. I don't have money, I don't have food. So again, it's just trying to, you know, that the figure is telling you that they exist, and these are aspects of Thai society, of Bangkok life, that are, of course, hidden. So it's very light at the moment while I'm thinking, but I'm basically trying to establish some critical context for these photographs, because they are very controversial, they're extremely disturbing, but my only argument is they exist now. They're also interesting as art, because I don't know who would buy them. You couldn't buy one. She shows them in galleries. They've been collected by like the Kinsey Institute. They're very queer because they don't fit anywhere. They were collected by the Kinsey Institute in Indiana, but I'm not sure what they're telling you. They're not really telling you anything about sex work. They've been bought by a couple of collectors, but only anonymously, because who wants to have a glossy photograph of a street kid on their wall? So there's a lot of those more subversive elements in terms of the art market. And again, there's a queer lack of, there's a queer challenge to classification. And so seeing as I'm here, another book that I've really enjoyed, I just mentioned, was Hold It Against Me by Jennifer Doyle, which talks about emotion and contemporary art. Okay.
Well, Brian, thank you so much. That's also a great book. Brian, I want to thank you for talking with me today, and I want to wish you success on the book coming out shortly.
Brilliant. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.